So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today as we talk a bit about honeybees and honeybee colonies with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Glad to have him along. And certainly if you have some questions, feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Phil, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Nice to be here, Larry.
As I mentioned before the show started in my little promotion there, more than 21 states have reported problems of honeybee colonies suffering from this illness called colony collapse disorder. And mysterious, I guess, is a word for it.
Well, the problem is people haven't been able to nail down a single cause. I mean, there are a number of theories on this, and it has really been going on for quite some time. Some people think even into the late 1980s. It has been recorded in Europe. In fact, one of the names it's referred to in Europe is the vanishing bee syndrome. But when you hear the term syndrome or disorder, you know that things aren't totally nailed down. And I think really what has gotten people's attention is, rather than being kind of a low-level underlying problem, and honeybees have had an awful lot of problems in the last 15 to 20 years with varroa mites and whatnot, but there seems to be a very accelerated loss of bees down south. And, you know, we have a lot of beekeepers that are migratory that will move their colonies down south and overwinter the bees there and then basically move up as crops need pollination. And just devastating losses. I had seen one figure of a beekeeper that had 1,200 hives and was down to 9.
And, oh, man.
So it's and we've been losing honeybees for the last 30 years. I mean, there has been a gradual decline, and I've seen figures to suggest that we have half the bees in this country now that we did, honeybees, that is, as we did in 1971.
And, you know, the National Research Council noted that in order to bear fruit, of course, three-quarters of all flowering plants, including most food crops and some that provide fiber or drugs or fuel, rely on pollinators for fertilization. And honeybees aren't the only pollinators, but they've played a very important role.
Yeah, I mean, we have lots of native pollinators, but you can't manipulate them very easily. Whereas honeybees, we can pick up the colonies and move them on a truck to another place. And, you know, it's reasonably well understood how you can manage these bees. And really, bumblebees to some degree are managed for greenhouses and the like. But honeybees are really the only ones that have lent themselves for people to manipulate. And so right now, the almond growers in California are just screaming because of the lack of pollinating bees. And I assume we're going to continue to hear these kind of problems throughout the United States as things warm up.
Well, Helen in Primrose has a bee question for you. So let's go to Helen. Hi, Helen. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm a bee lover and welcome the bees in general, but for the last two summers, I've been pretty severely bitten by, I don't know, I suppose ground bees, or I don't know if they're called hornets or if that's different, very small and dark and just really followed me when I ran away. I believe they came up out of the ground because I was weeding under a little ginkgo tree. And then in the fall when I went back, however, I found a paper nest on the lower branches of two little ginkgo trees. Listening to you, I bought 7, but I never got the courage to go and use it. And now that spring is coming, I would like to know, well, when can I go at this? And exactly how do I know where they are and where to apply it?
There's no need to go after it because those are not truly bees. I mean, bees to entomologists, among other things, are things that gather pollen and nectar and don't make these paper wasp-type nests. You had one species of yellow jacket or hornet, and they were defensive when things were disturbed, but they basically freeze out. They don't come back and overwinter as colonies, which is a unique factor for honeybees. And that's one of the things that goes on with honeybees is, you know, traditionally, even without all these problems in our state, we can lose upwards to half our bees trying to get them through the winter because they have to be strong enough in numbers and they have to have enough honey to be able to produce heat to generate through the whole winter. And if not, they basically starve and freeze out is what happens to our honeybees. But all other bees that we have in this state overwinter as fertile queens, and then they start their colonies from scratch in the spring and have nothing to do with the old colony. So there's no need to worry about that. You can let it weather off. You can cut it off. But there will be no critters associated with that paper wasp.
Take it inside the house. There's nothing in there anymore, and they won't come back to that same.
No, they don't utilize it, which is apparently a behavioral trait. Because you think about it, if there's a disease problem or whatnot in the colony and you come back, then you're going to get sick. And so it seems to be smart to start from scratch.
All right. Thanks, Helen. And Dan in Hillsboro, your question. Hi.
Hello. I was working on my fence last summer, and I heard a humming noise that I've never encountered before. Within a few minutes, I found myself in the middle of a swarm. And the swarm, I was out there 45 minutes, and there were still stragglers traveling through. And they were thick enough to darken the air around me. It would be difficult to put a number on it, but I would say on the order of millions. And I can't guarantee you they were honeybees either, but they looked like honeybees.
Boy, if they look like a bee, the honeybee is the only critter that really does swarm. And it really, it's a mechanism for the colonies to break and divide. And typically, beekeepers can manipulate the colony in a way so this doesn't happen, because basically they lose the bees. You know, before we had the varroa mites and some of these other problems that have moved in and caused us such loss of bees, even before this collapse disorder, these what we'd call feral or wild bees would find an old hollow tree or whatnot and set up housekeeping. And so we had, even though, you know, honeybees are not native, they're European, but they've been in this country for two centuries. So we could rely on these feral honeybees that were out there. But now, because most beekeepers have to medicate their bees and treat them to prevent the mites and other disorders, we find that the feral bees don't do very well. And so it's a somewhat unusual thing to see a lot. You can see them swarming. You can see them establishing a new colony. But those colonies often don't survive the winter because of the mite problems and other things they get when they're not cared for.
Interesting. Thanks.
So they're also very docile at this point. You know, as you observe, they can be around. You'll often see them congregate on a fence post or some open area, and they're basically waiting for the scout bees to find this new home. And once they find it, they'll pick up lock, stock, and barrel and move. Sometimes it takes a couple days, but if you ever see this phenomenon, aside from it being really neat, the best thing to do is leave them be. They'll go and take care of themselves, and as I said, within a day or two, they'll be gone. And sometimes it's just a matter of a couple hours.
Yeah, interesting.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it normal to see them in such numbers, and is it possible that they were migrating north?
The numbers to me seem way above what we normally would expect, and we usually deal with you know, 10,000 bees, something like that, even less than that in a swarm. They don't migrate big distances. You know, it wouldn't be unusual, I think, for a colony to move a couple, 3 miles, maybe even a little bit more than that. But they're not by nature an animal that goes, you know, from one state to the next. That's just, you know, and part of it, again, is, you know, there's an awful lot of food demands at that time. And that's what part of the colony is about, is the storage of honey and pollen, which is kind of their food stores that all the bees share and feed to their young. And without having a, quote, colony, I don't know, as I said, how they could sustain themselves for that long. Yeah,
interesting. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Katrina in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Katrina.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I live in Milwaukee now, but I used to live in Ashapin, Wisconsin, which is home to a really wonderful honey museum. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I noticed on one of our trips there was that honeybees pollinate fruits and vegetables like tomatoes and cucumbers. And so then over the years, I've been wondering, well, how do they grow tomatoes and why not indoors without the pollination of honeybees?
Well, you know, some crops can self-pollinate to some degree, but bees either increase the yield or, in the case of strawberries, the size of the fruit. But be honest, in greenhouse tomatoes, they bring in bumblebees. You can do it by hand, but they have colonies of bumblebees that they use to pollinate, and that's somewhat of a new area. They've been doing it in Europe for quite a bit longer than we have here, but that's what they do, is they bring in a honeybee. I mean, bumblebee colonies are much smaller, but the bees do provide that service. But you're right. I mean, many of our crops, you know, here we're concerned about apples, cherries, cranberries, cucumbers, in particular. In fact, most of the vine crops are relatively dependent. And that's one of the things that I've witnessed in my career, is that people that used to be able to rely on these wild feral bees for pollination aren't seeing it anymore. So we have some fresh market producers that honestly either have to get somebody to come in or start learning how to raise bees themselves, just because without those pollination services, they don't get their crops.
Mm. That's wonderful. So those cute little honeybees not only can increase your yield, but make the size of your fruit or vegetable a little bigger.
Yep. Right. And they say it depends on the crop, but that's what happens in strawberries, is the difference is the size of the berry with the bees working it or not.
Wow, cute and helpful. Go honeybees.
Thanks, Katrina.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. David in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good.
I'm fine.
So I've been a beekeeper in the upper Midwest for about 30 years and have been through many of the types of problems that you've been talking about with mites and different diseases and so forth. But this colony collapse disorder is a new animal on the block, I guess. I really have not experienced this. My bees, fortunately, keep my fingers crossed, had a very good winter, came through in great shape. But as I hear about this, the one thing that really strikes me is how many times I hear that a beekeeper has gone in back into the hive and he's found some honey, he's found some brood, maybe even a queen, but no bees in the hive. And that indicates to me that the bees are either dying slowly one by one and being carried out of the hive by the workers, or something's happening to them when they're outside the hive. And that's a new situation that we've never really had to deal with before, and I think it's one of the reasons that we're having a hard time figuring out what is going on.
Right, and it's, you know, because you don't have any bodies to do autopsies on.
Probably
most of the work going on right now that I'm aware of is at Penn State. They have a number of researchers, and you know, they have dissected some of these bees and seem to find that there's an immune response going on, that there's something causing a weakening. And that's the other interesting thing, that there seems to be an underlying stress factor that kind of set the bees up. And so people have even used the analogy of HIV and AIDS, where it appears that they're getting exposed or infected with something, and then there's kind of this delay. And as you say, one of the common symptoms of this disorder is the older bees just disappear. And there's just nothing there. So there's not dead bees around, and it happens relatively quickly. And so, as I said, people have looked at pesticides. Some of the newer pesticides cause behavioral changes in the bees. They don't learn as well. But the funny thing is no matter what you look at, it just doesn't pattern to fit all the things going on. It does not appear to be overly contagious in the sense that if people reuse, you know, equipment and whatnot, it is not necessarily there. So as I said, it's people are really looking a number of directions and even asking the question, is this a complex of things that set the bees up? Some people have even talked about the potential of all the things that we're using to, you know, prevent mites and other things may be a factor here. But as I said, that alone is not what's going on. And the other thing I think is for people who one of my dear friends is Emmett Harp, who was a USDA bee person here. And we used to be lucky enough to have a USDA bee lab here up until about 15 years or so ago. And they moved to Tucson, which has really hurt us as a department because we don't have any real true bee expertise. But Emmett's kept bees for a long time. And he and I have chatted a couple times on this one. And he said, you know, one of the things you got to be careful of is people that are not careful. He lost quite a few bees coming into the fall because of just not keeping on top of the mites. And Emmett's a very good beekeeper. He had a comment similar to yours that at least last I talked to him is his bees seem to come through very strongly, which is very encouraging. And, you know, as far as this disorder, I have not been able. I think some of the reports we're getting out of Wisconsin, maybe migratory beekeepers that are down south that are coming back to Wisconsin. I think it's a little early to call for us here if we really are seeing a lot of it in the state. But it very shortly, I think we'll start to get a picture of what's going on.
And I think also, you know, the common thread that I hear is migratory beekeepers reporting this problem. Well, that's an extremely stressful way to manage bees. And with all the feeding that is done of different types of corn syrups and so forth and pollen supplements, there's a lot of things that could go wrong in that process. And I've known of quite a few beekeepers in this area that have sent their bees out to California for almonds or other places and had tremendous losses in those colonies simply because of the stress of moving them and bringing them back again.
Yeah, right. And as I said, so it's interesting, but the thing that seems to be catching everybody's attention is that even though there's always been a low-level underlying issue here, something has really accelerated in the last 8 to 10 months. And as I said, that's what I think people are scrambling on. And it would not surprise me that it's going to take a couple years to put all the pieces together, and hopefully this thing quiets down before then.
Yeah. To keep bees here in the wintertime, do some beekeepers put their bees inside kind of buildings, not heated buildings necessarily, but that offer some protection from the elements or not?
Well, I think more often than not, they try to select a site that has some natural protection rather than putting it in. I don't know of any people that keep them indoors. I know there was research done here back when we did have a USDA bee lab at looking at ways of improving. In fact, that was one of their main tasks up here, is to figure ways of manipulating the colonies to get them through the winter better. But I just, don't know of, you know, to have a building big enough, and you know, some of our beekeepers literally have hundreds of colonies. And so it's more or less setting the colonies up, trying to get them strong enough going in the winter by manipulating them that they have a good chance of surviving. Make sure they've got enough honey, that it's in the right place so the bees can get to it. Those all come into play.
So. Larry, that's overwintering in an enclosure is something that is often done in Canada, where you have long periods of sub-zero temperatures that are very, very stressful on the colonies. But we've been having very mild winters here in Wisconsin. And while many hobbyist beekeepers, for example, may wrap their colonies to prevent the wind cutting through or provide some extra insulation, generally speaking, it isn't really necessary here.
Oh, interesting. Have you read Holly Bishop's book, Robbing the Bees?
I have not read it. I am familiar with it, though.
I really enjoyed that book, and anybody who's, of course, you probably know most of what's in that book, but it's an entertaining book, and for anybody who's interested in bees at all, it's a very entertaining book.
Well, I was impressed by our first caller that mistook wasps for bees, and that's a real common problem for beekeepers, or people, especially with the German yellow jackets coming in.
Yeah.
Always blaming the honeybee for getting stung when often it's the yellow jacket that's doing it.
David, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking bees here. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking bees today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, visiting a bit about colony collapse disorder, that mysterious illness that's threatening many honeybee colonies. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Charles next in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I wonder what would happen if you had a huge map and you put a pin where they use different kinds and how much insecticides. We do a lot of spraying and insecticiding down here for mosquitoes and everything else the last 30 years. What would happen if you approach it that way? What does happen when you approach it that way?
Well, they do look in the products they've been looking at in particular, because, again, I think the argument is that insecticides we've been using for the last 30 years, this is a relatively new disorder, so they're tending to look at some of the newer products that weren't here at that point. And there's a product, imidacloprid, which is a systemic insecticide in small amounts of the insecticide, can get mixed with pollen. And so that's one of the ones that is known, that it has some toxicity right off to bees, but also it has this behavioral effect that it prevents the bees from learning. And so one of the theories was that young bees that have to kind of go out and find their way in the world, but also find their way back to the colony, were getting confused and lost and weren't able to come back to the colony. But as I said, looking at the pattern of the use, and that product has been used worldwide for at least the last 12 to 15 years, and this is a recent effect. And so it wouldn't surprise me that there might be an underlying pesticide factor that is a stress factor. And again, that's the one thing that seems the bees have to be pushed and stressed to make them susceptible to this disorder, from what we can tell. So as I said, people are looking at it, but that's the one thing, is as they're interviewing beekeepers that are suffering the losses, the first thing is to sort out, is this really a collapse disorder, or is there some other problems, viruses and whatnot, that come to play? And then looking at all the things they do and what they witnessed, and then they're kind of putting this in a database and trying to sift through this to see if there's a pattern, and there's just nothing that's glaring yet. And that's, they said, why they're really approaching this from four or five different research fronts, trying to see if they can really understand it.
Charles, thanks. Appreciate it very much. Jim in Decorah, Iowa, we'll take your call now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I guess you just covered what I was going to talk about, the insecticide they used on sunflowers in France, which caused the sword disappearing syndrome. But I'm wondering if this is a herbicide or a chemical-induced problem, then we stand to possibly lose even the wild solitary pollinators, because they all have to find their nests again.
Mm-hmm.
This could be a tip of an iceberg.
Yeah.
No one follows the populations of the wild pollinators usually, so you don't notice when they disappear. But the honeybees are pretty obvious when you open a colony and Yeah. Nothing there.
Nothing there.
Right. Well, people have a lot more interest, and I think even before this disorder, the problems with varroa mite and other things that have caused, you know, declines in honeybees, people are starting to say, well, you know, maybe we have to see, at least find ways of preserving our natives as best we can and get the benefit from it. And so more and more people are looking at that. The story in France gets quite complicated, and I will not confess to be an expert with it, but, you know, the product that I had mentioned has been banned in France. But yet some of the research I've seen generated since then suggests that there's more going on than that. And, and as I said, you know, I fear that people are going to oversimplify this, and it does seem to be a pretty complicated story as far as what's setting up the disorder. And as I said, the pattern just doesn't fit totally, because this chemical has been used in potatoes in Wisconsin and in a number of other crops, and without seeing this problem. And so, as I said, it just doesn't always overlap with where we're seeing the disorder.
Interesting.
In New England, when it was used in potatoes, they got it in their cover crops the next year, too. So it's a long-lasting compound,
a couple of
years' worth.
Yeah. To be honest, when it first came on the market, I was quite surprised, because generally something that's a systemic has a relatively long residual, and that always is something that's kind of a red flag with a pesticide. But this stuff is not overly water-soluble, so it didn't pose quite the groundwater problems of some of the other products. But again, this carryover, and there are restrictions in certain cases as far as replanting the next year, what you can replant, those kind of things with it. The interesting thing is I had seen a figure recently that has become the number one used insecticide worldwide, which surprised me quite a bit, because it's from a relatively new family of compounds, and I would have guessed it's something else. So it is in widespread use and will continue to be, and there are similar products coming on the market now that have slightly different chemical traits, but same thing, systemics. They are basically a nicotine-like product. Their neonicotinoids are the family, and they work in a very similar manner to nicotine, which is a nerve poison itself.
And this is imidacloprid.
Right.
Okay.
Or what, you know, we call it Marathon, and sold under, you know, a large number of trade names.
Jim, I thank you very much for calling. I want to get some others a chance here. David in Soldiers Grove, we turn to you now. Hi, David.
Hi. I'm an amateur beekeeper, and I'm wondering if there's anything you can suggest that we do to try to protect our bees from, you know, I mean, it sounds like not very much is known about this die-off. So, I mean, I'm personally, like, I'm kind of trying to jack up the volume on all the hygienic practices that I'm doing to begin with, you know, and is there any other thing that we can do to try to help, you know, not get it?
Well, you know, it doesn't appear to be contagious per se. I mean, you know, because again, if you move colonies into a pre-used colony, you'd think they'd all get sick if it was something they were picking up, and they're, you know, you don't see that correlation straightforward. And I guess the things that you're doing, it you know, it goes back to the stress factor. If the bees aren't stressed and healthy, there seems to not to be a problem. And in particular, as David had mentioned, is, you know, right now from what we're seeing, it's the migratory beekeepers that are having, you know, they've always had colony losses, but this is really accelerated for them. And so I think I'm hopeful that the hobbyists are not going to see the problem, that, you know, keeping their own bees on their own property or you know, close by and caring for them, that, as I said, whereas if it was known to be infective, it was a virus that the mites were spreading or whatnot, then you say, oh, boy, you know, this is going to be a real stinker. But so far, that has not appeared to be it. So I think what you're doing of keeping the bees strong is exactly the direction to go.
Okay.
Thanks, David.
Thanks. You bet.
Bob and Iola, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good show again, guys.
Thanks.
This one's really appropriate. It's good that it's Beekeeper's Day rather than Ladybug Day again. hey, I used to keep bees, and a number of other friends, or three other guys around here that had bees. We were all wiped out, probably by mites. But one of the things that I've been thinking about in this is that the BT corn, that killer gene that Monsanto puts in, talking about feeding supplemental pollen, they prove that this pollen can kill monarch butterflies, and it's out in a huge percentage of the commercial corn crop, is my understanding. What do you think of the BT pollen?
The protein, the toxic protein that's associated with BT, is extremely effective against caterpillars, and that's why the monarchs are susceptible. But bees don't have the right pH or whatnot and appear not to be susceptible at all. And so it's a very valid question to ask, and to be honest, it's one that's been looked at because bees utilize pollen, even corn pollen at times. And so, you know, that was, I don't think is a factor. Now, you know, again, this thing of if it is an immune response that something is weakening it, you know, then I would say maybe in a long shot, it's well worth looking at that aspect. Again, I'm not familiar enough with the research to know if they've really gotten down to that level. But just on the surface, this is a relatively selective pesticide that needs a certain pH. It needs to be ingested. And then it basically causes a gut tract paralysis, among other things, in susceptible insects. And we just haven't seen honeybees show that effect when they're exposed to it.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Bob. John in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a kind of a question, a comment. I'm just a hobbyist. I have a couple of hives. I managed to get mine through the winter. One of them I knew was a little weak, and I just used granulated sugar. They survived, and then I've got some pollen patties and some other patties now this spring that the weaker colony really attacked as far as feeding them, so that's really important that they have food for the winter. My thoughts I just wanted to throw out there, where these bees disappear and they're not finding any bees to analyze, do the bees use any kind of magnetic sensing for directions, and if that would be involved in any way, because there are currently changes going on in the Earth's magnetic field, is it possible that they're getting lost?
That's interesting. I'm not enough of a bee specialist. I mean, they use polarized light and other things. It's really quite intriguing how bees both learn and can communicate to each other of, you know, pollen sources and the like. But I don't know. As I said, the one thing from the scientific sense, the researchers in Pennsylvania, when they dissect the bees, they are finding areas that are darkening up, melanized areas, which is one of the immune defenses in insects, where they're not seeing it in bees that apparently aren't showing this disorder. And that's why they think there's this immune response, that there's something that's weakening the immune system. And then that may open up the bee to be susceptible to things that normally weren't a problem.
No.
So that's, I think, the general direction we're seeing the research go right now. And that's why one of the things the researchers at Penn State have been doing, as I said, is surveying beekeepers, really giving a very long questionnaire, and then using that in a database and trying to see what patterns they're picking up. And aside from doing the internal autopsies that they think, there's also an amoeba problem in bees that get into their Malpighian tubules. That can cause problems, and some people speculated that it's associated with that. But that pattern doesn't pan out when they're doing the dissection. So as I said, it's interesting to see the number of directions they're looking, but there just is nothing in getting. But that's an interesting one on the magnetic one. I'll have to pass it on to as I said, we don't have any bee researchers here. The closest one is up in the University of Minnesota, Dr. Marla Spivak, who has worked quite a bit with bee breeding, in particular with coming up with bees that are less susceptible to varroa mite, which has been, you know, one of the major headaches of the last 10 to 15 years for beekeepers.
Well, that was what I was curious about, because I understood basically that the bees are simply disappearing and they're not, you know, having any, like you say, bodies to analyze, and I wonder if, you know, they're just simply, if this magnetic thing, there are spots apparently around the world, I don't know where, that these magnetic fields are making major changes. I think the poles, they indicate that the actual poles are going to switch. This occurs, I guess, about every 1,000 years, or I don't know how often, but if the bees, since they aren't finding any bees to basically analyze, I'm just wondering if they're using some of these magnetic fields to navigate to and from the hives.
Yeah, but typically when bees die in a colony, they're carried out of the colony.
And you often find the dead bodies just underneath the hive.
Yeah, they just usually just dump them right out.
But again, I mean, the comment is there seems to be a bit of a behavioral effect. And as I said, that's why they were looking at one of the pesticides, is if the bees can't learn, they can't find their way back. Well, again, if it's magnetic related, the same thing, they can't find their way back. And it's just, They just disappear, as I said, and that's the thing that is perplexing, because it's all the older bees. It's kind of like they all pick up lock, stock, and barrel in a short time, but there's no sign of decline in the colony there. There's cat brood, so they're raising young. Mm-hmm. The only bees you do see are the young bees that are just emerging and whatnot. And as I said, it's just a very interesting phenomena on the behavioral side that ends up killing the colony.
What happens? That's a kind of an interesting point. What happens to those when those young bees, where when they emerge and there's nobody else there, do they just die or what are they?
Well, part of it is there's not enough of a force to take care of the colony.
Yeah.
You know, not getting food, raising young. I mean, all the things. And, you know, bees as they mature have different responsibilities,
yeah.
You know, and the like. And so it does cause major stress. And as I said, the bottom line is the colonies get so weak that they just die off.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, I haven't got a real good phone line. I just want to make a couple quick comments and see what Phil has to say. We had experience keeping our bees in a structure. I heard a previous fellow saying that we ran them in a small polyethylene unheated greenhouse, and we found we got about a 25% buildup, added strength to the hives doing that. And my feeling always was when we had a fair number of hives that you were best off keeping those hives as strong as possible. Just like a healthy person, you know, you've got a little bit more oomph and something comes along and kicks you, and you don't have a problem with that. And talking to the commercial beekeepers at the Wisconsin Farmers Market at Madison, they told me they're seeing a general decline in the quality of the nukes and their package bees they're able to purchase to start their summer hives. And I wonder, or spring hives, excuse me. I wondered if Phil thought maybe there's an overwhelming with the mites and all our happy other things in this decline, if we aren't seeing a physical decline in the quality of the population of bees themselves. In other words, if we don't have a genetic defect here that we've kind of selected for weaker bees, and maybe something's got to be added to the bee lines to bring some oomph back into it.
Well, that could play, and it would not surprise me, again, that the secret is in breeding. I think people maybe don't realize how much artificial insemination and other manipulations are done with bees, and again, that's much of the direction that Dr. Spivak has went with, is selecting and then breeding specific bees that have behavioral traits that make them less prone. It'll be very interesting. I have a feeling people are going to have a very difficult time getting bees this spring because there are no bees to be gotten per se, and that's going to cause problems. So, there's just all kinds of repercussions to what's been going on in the last few months.
Just one other comment. I was never madly in love with the miticides for the mites. I always thought to myself, I've got a hive full of insects, and I'm treating it with insecticide. I understand they're selective, but it just always, to me, seemed like less than an ultimate solution to the problem.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think that's still on the table as one of the factors that might be coming to play in this. It's, again, we are throwing an awful lot of things in the colony now, you know, feeling that we have to because the bees have got enough problems. But is that setting them up for some other further things? And as I said, it still could be.
Do you know of anything of this? They were bringing some of these Russian and European strains in and working. I think that was initially for the mite problem. Do you know of anything of that's progressed at all?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the strain that Marla Spivak is being released to commercial beekeepers. And they're clean bees. They do a lot of grooming, which cuts down on the mite pressure and the like, and so that is the direction she has went with her research. And again, my friend Emmett Harp, who used to be in the USDA bee lab here, that was his expertise, is breeding bee lines. And one of the disappointing things is when Emmett retired and the bee lab moved, they let a lot of his lines go. And so there was a lot of interesting genetic traits and breeding stock that we could still use now. And I know they still do that kind of breeding elsewhere, but it was a disappointing thing involved with Emmett's research.
Mm. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil, for calling. Gene in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I've heard that the manufacturers of GMO crops have used nanoparticles to manipulate the genes, facilitate the manipulation of the genes of the crops. And this could produce, since nanoparticles travel, it could produce pollen with nanoparticles in it. And also BT crops are a mistake.
All right.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not a gene jockey, so I'm not even sure of what the technology and manipulations that they're utilizing. You know, people have different opinions on BT. It's a, it's a natural bacteria. Some of the strains have toxic protein, some of them don't. But of course, then taking the genes of those and putting them to plants is where we come into the discussion. Is this a natural product or not? You know, you look in the short run, the interesting thing, you know, there's a lot of people that are very nervous about this technology being worn out. You know, the both for the BT corn for corn borer and the BT for killing rootworms, in order to keep a genetic diversity in our pest populations, there's a requirement of having refuges. And there's a lot of worry that people won't follow those directions and they'll become resistant to this overnight or relatively quickly, and that whole technology will be down the drain.
And thanks again, Gene, for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned bumblebees earlier, and someone else called in and just wondered if bumblebees have a mean streak, or are they generally docile? You know, they're being used in greenhouses and so forth.
We have about 9 or 10 species of bumblebees, and to be honest, different species have different personalities. Mostly they're pretty docile, but there's a couple of the prairie species that I describe as grumpy. They don't tolerate a lot of activity. They are really quite aggressive. It's always defending the colony. And so if they're coming to sting you, you're within 10 or 15 feet of the colony, whereas some of the other bumblebees, you can sit right outside the nest, and as long as you don't, you know, play loud music or pour gasoline down the nest or something, they'll leave you alone. So,
well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. I really appreciate you being with us today, and you'll be back in about a month, and then we'll expand the topic to maybe we'll talk bees a little bit, but then we'll talk all kinds of insects as well.
Thanks. Sounds good.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Always fun to have him along, and we zeroed in on bees today, and we'll open it up to a broader range of insects next time he's on the show. Speaking of a broader range, we'll expand our topics right now and talk with you about the best spring outings in Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula. There are a lot of good ones, and some that you might not have really thought much about. Eric Hansen's got some answers for us, and he'll be up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.